Good morning and welcome to the United Lodge of Theosophists here in Philadelphia. You are going to hear a rendition of the Declaration that is kind of paraphrased and has very little reflection of the true beauty of the document. So if you are new to the building or new to the movement, you want to avail yourself of one of these periodicals. There are a couple of pages of philosophical statements and then the list of our quarterly offerings, much of which you will hear today. But one of the beauties on the back of the page is a very brief statement of the declaration of the policy of ULT that we as students in Philadelphia hold dear. That reminds me, if you have a cell phone, please take the time to turn it off. Philadelphia, as all the lodges around the world, are independently devoted to the cause of theosophy. So that if you walk into any one of the lodges around the world, you will see similarity in that there will be an associated group of free thinkers who volunteer to help keep things moving in terms of keeping the ideas alive and out for the public. But beyond that, everything is autonomous. And the reason for that is that there's no organization. There's no politics, there's no organization, there's no institutional bylaws, officers, dues. Any of the hierarchy of any bureaucracy is gone. Rather, these declared purposes, and there's only four or five paragraphs, is what cements the cause around the globe and across time and places for all folks. There is an individual attraction to the philosophy of theosophy. There's an individual drive by conscience as to what the volunteerism will be. And so the loyalty of the association of these free thinkers is to the theosophical movement. It is to the philosophy itself. It's to the founders of the theosophical movement. And little or no time, virtually no time in these rooms, is given to individual opinions or current events or side issues of any kind. The overall goal is to study the philosophy, study how to apply the theosophy in a shared attempt to realize what it is to be truly human, what is the true nature of humankind, and what is the true basis for that. Universal brotherhood and altruism, both ideal and real as applied. And so in terms of the movement, all those souls around the globe, wherever you may see a situation where there is a selfless service of humanity, a selfless service of a charitable cause for the good of the environment, anywhere that you see self-sacrificing, it is said that though that's a reflection of the movement and that's a reflection of pure theosophy and a pure theosophical student who may even be unaware of that fact. So welcome into any building without cost would be anyone who wants to fit themselves by study and otherwise to be the better able to serve humanity. And so there's no distinctions here of age or race or sex or creed or any kind of societal ranking of any kind that's left at the door. And frankly, as one-on-one souls, there is an effort to understand and apply universal brotherhood. It is also said at the last statement is that the theosophist belongs to no cult or sect, yet belongs to each and all. So in Philadelphia, you will see a definite attempt to compare religions, to compare religious philosophies, to understand them. And having said all that, not as beautifully as it was originally synthesized and written, if you feel your heartstrings are tugged by what you hear in these rooms or through any of the activities, please feel free to speak to the individual who may be volunteering at the book table before or after class to see how you might fit your efforts into volunteering for the cause. In Philadelphia, the building is open weekly on Sundays and Wednesdays for the public use. It is also on the third Friday of the month opened again. On Sundays, we have, the building opens at 10:30. There's someone at the book table if you would like to look through selections for home use. And then the classes always begin promptly at 11 and last until 12. During the month of February, we're using a general theme of theosophy and myths and allegories. This morning's talk that you will hear shortly is the value and purpose of myths. Next Sunday, February 21st, is a title, The Hidden Treasures in the Bible. And again, we're dealing with myths and allegories in the light of the philosophy of theosophy. On Wednesday nights during the winter session, the building opens at 5:30. There's a student who is volunteering to work a high-quality reference library. That library stays open from 5:30 to 7:30. So if you want to pre-read something for class participation, if you have an individual line of research that you're interested in, you can come in and get help using the straight line collection of literature. At 7:45, very promptly again, there is a study class that starts on Wednesday nights. We're using The Ocean of Theosophy by William Q. Judge. It's a compendium of articles that appeared in the newspaper in the late 1800s. It's actually a very ideal form of the Reader's Digest in that it's a synthesis of the greater companion, Secret Doctrine, Volumes 1 and 2. And this coming Wednesday night, we'll be continuing our reading and study of the topic of reincarnation. So everyone's invited to participate in that way as well. This coming Friday evening is the third Friday of the month, February 19th. The building will open at 6:30, parking across the street, given that it's available, is where you can park after 6:30. And the title at that point is part of a series. There's a triptych. Reincarnation in Myth and Symbol is an ongoing Friday night comparison across 3 months. And February 19th, the topic is the Phoenix and the Serpent. So those two concepts will be discussed from a view of theosophy from around the world and cross cultures. At any time before or after one of these sessions, you can look at books or pamphlets or periodicals at the table for purchase for home. They are offered at cost. So the cost of the publication and transferring or transporting the piece here is the only thing that you pay for. There's no profit. Additionally, we have Theosophical Independence, which is put together by students here at the Lodge, and the volunteers have prepared December 2009 and January 2010. So those two are free and available, and they're behind the usher's table. So having said all that, this morning's topic, in terms of myths and allegories, our title is The Value and Purpose of Myths, and we have a brief talk that will be treated to.
Good morning. Myths and symbols are considered of sufficient importance in the secret doctrine to devote one-third of each of its two volumes to their discussion. Volume 1 contains 15 chapters on the subject. Now, to much of the Western mind, myths are misunderstood, mainly because the Western mind prefers facts and measurements. And facts and measurements, don't get me wrong, facts and measurements have served us well. Facts and measurements have made possible our wonderful highways and many of the technological things that we enjoy. But facts and measurements become feeble when they're faced with what has been called many times this veil of tears under which we live. In such a world as this, the symbolic stories of myth help reconcile humanity to a reality that might otherwise be unknowable and unbearable. Myths are not the products of some simple primitive mind, but the offerings of ancient genius. They contain universal truths, too large to be confined in mere historical facts, too grand to be captured in dry scientific data, and too noble to be confined in ethics, customs, and morals of one tribe or nation. The universal horizons that myths lay open to those who can see show where we have been and where we are going. Myths acquaint us with the ideas that put humanity in accord with the intimate workings of nature. We read the following in the Secret Doctrine. Spirit, then, or cosmic ideation and cosmic substance, one of whose principles is ether, are one, and include the elements in the sense St. Paul attaches to them. These elements are the veiled synthesis standing for the Dion Chohans, Devas, Sephiroths, Archangels, etc. The ether of science, the illus of the protile of chemistry, constitutes, so to speak, the rude material out of which the above named builders, following the plan traced out for them eternally in the divine thought, fashion the systems of the cosmos. They are myths, we are told, no more so than the ether and the atoms. We answer, the two latter are absolute necessities of physical science. The builders are as absolute necessity of metaphysics. We are twitted with, you never saw them. We ask the materialists, have you ever seen ether or your atoms or again your force? A clearer understanding of myths can be drawn from that preceding quote, and also a better understanding of the conflict that exists between the ancient Eastern and modern Western minds. Joseph Campbell, the renowned mythologist, said that the modern Western mind, while not understanding the word metaphor, hears the word myth and substitutes the word lie. He goes on to say, God is a metaphor for a mystery that absolutely transcends all human category of thought. Theosophy concurs, saying, scriptures down to the Egyptians, Greeks, and Romans, and finally to the Jewish sacred word records, all have the same origin. None are meaningless and baseless stories invented to entrap the unwary profane. All are allegories intended to convey under a more or less fantastic veil the great truths gathered in the same field of prehistoric tradition. The study and respect of myth has many champions. Among them, the aforementioned Joseph Campbell, Carl Jung, Eric Fromm, who in his book, The Forgotten Language, wrote, the dreams of ancient and modern man are written in the same language as the myths whose authors lived in the dawn of history. Yet this language has been forgotten by modern man, not when he is asleep, but when he is awake. Those of us who come here regularly have often heard this, the phrase, the nighttime of the body is the daytime of the soul. This and what is just mentioned fit hand in glove and give us an understanding of what that particular phrase means. Carl Jung's theory of the collective unconscious stated briefly, a more or less superficial layer of the unconscious layer is undoubtedly personal. But this personal unconscious rests upon a deeper layer, which does not derive from personal experience. It is inborn, this deeper layer. I call the collective unconscious. It has contents and modes of behavior that are more or less the same everywhere and in all individuals, and thus constitute a common psychic substrata of a superpersonal nature, which is present in every one of us. This statement by Jung mirrors an idea expressed in the Secret Doctrine 40 years earlier. HBB, speaking of myths, mythic abnormal of being, states, the imagination of the masses, disorderly and ill-regulated as it may be, could never have conceived and fabricated so many monstrous figures, such a wealth of extraordinary tales, had it not had to serve it as a central nucleus, those floating reminiscences, obscure and vague, which unite the broken links of the chain of time to form with them the mysterious dream foundation of our collective consciousness. Once again, I'd like to quote Joseph Campbell from his book, Hero with a Thousand Faces. Myth is the secret opening through which inexhaustible energies of the cosmos pour into human cultural manifestations. Religions, philosophies, arts, the social forms of primitive historic man, prime discoveries in science and technology, the very dreams that blister sleep boil up from the basic magic ring of myth. The symbols of mythology are not manufactured. They cannot be ordered, invented, or permanently suppressed. They are spontaneous productions of the psyche, and each bears within it, undamaged, the germ power of its source. Myth has also found respect and champions in the creative community, who are themselves modern myth makers, when at their best helping to shape the character of modern society, and at their most aware, they draw from the ancient myth makers, which can be seen in popular entertainment, such as films and books, The Matrix, The Wizard of Oz, Mary Shelley's Frankenstein, and the writings of T.S. Eliot, Thornton Wilder, and others, and other artistic disciplines. From this, we can see that man and myth are companions, destined to supply sustenance one to the other.
Thank you. So there we have our springboard with ample time for questions and answers and discussions on the value and the purpose of myths. I'm sure you came to the room this morning with lots of thoughts of your own. Yes?
Growing up, as a child, you were told many stories about some giants, dwarves, little people. The contrast the world in which we live, you know, like this other idea. Thank you.
the question is, are myths and childhood stories, and we know that there's a whole ladder, if you want to say, there are myths and legends, fables, glyphs, symbols, and fairy tales, children's little chants that we hear from the cradle all the way through grade school. And in earlier generations, frequently those were the vehicles for learning to read and write. Are they true? Do they have any basis in reality? Well, there's been a lot of work done among many, many scholars, and certainly among ancient seers, all the way back into the most shrouded periods of time, immemorial, that point to the fact that there are commonalities, that there are certain symbols that recur, that there are certain ideas that seem to recur. And the myths tend to be, of that hierarchy of childhood stories, it's the myths that we were taught that involve tremendous periods of so-called history that can't be tracked in written form. They frequently involve cosmological or supernatural traditions about the creation or the beginnings of time as it's known. Frequently myths have to do with gods and heroes. They tend to involve some kind of tale of human struggle, if you will. There's a moral to the story frequently. And in many, many ways, they can be told to a child as an exciting, exhilarating lesson of how to live. But they can also be studied at great leisure by a wise adult who's looking at the story and looking for symbols and hints about what was. Why is it that we are as we are? How did we come to be what we are? What's the meaning of life and where are we going? So that there are kernels of incredible essence that we intuitively respond to as children and as adults that reflect a much, much earlier time and point in consciousness. And your hand went up too. What would theosophy say about the negative view of, and it was mentioned in the talk, that myths are by some in the society seen as lies. In the philosophy, and as it said, you know, much of the original wonderful bouquet of the gathering of all that wisdom from so many cultures in so many earlier ages, much of that early bouquet of wisdom that was gifted to us in the Secret Doctrine and in the other sources points to the fact that it is in the myths that we can gain insight into the true nature of humanity, the source from which we emanate, the way in which life unfolds, and the path, the reason for our struggles in life and the path of growth, the contrast of the ideal and the real, but the path of growth. And these myths are universally symbolic. So what is stated in the philosophy, and which is a very, very interesting study, is that if we think back to the darkest reaches of our imagination of mankind, humankind in general, at a time period when even before the hunters and gatherers, there was a very simplistic lifestyle, very close to the earth or the ocean, where folks had not yet settled in river valley civilizations. They had not yet developed writing. There was no middleman of specialized scribes and temple servants to interpret things. So we're going back to a time period when the human mind and everything used by the human mind lived extremely close to nature and without writing. One of the most fascinating interplays of the philosophy is to look at the macrocosm, the entire universal cosmological beginning, and the microcosm, the human. And we know that in the caves, literally on the plains, in the caves, in the forests, as nomads, humans very frequently gathered around fires, and that's where the myths were told. They were recited by someone in the group who had a fabulous memory and was part of generations of oral tradition, and they were literally gifted to the rest of the group, the clan or the family or the tribe, however big the group was, as a memory of what it was like to have mind lit up for the first time. So that you've got this remarkable collective consciousness, this impress of spirit, Theosophy tells us, into individualization of the earliest of humans who had the greatest technology of all, voice. The ability to link the physical throat, the astral emotions and soul with mind, early thinking, and we're able to voice symbols and a collective memory of what it would be like for spirit to incarnate and invigorate matter. And in those early, early myths, we find tremendous power. You have the trust, the confidence, the intuitive wisdom that the speaker has truth to offer. You have that entire supernatural communication of listening, people using their imaginations and thinking about what is being said and what the symbols mean. And then intuitively, independently, as they're moving around the globe, beginning to try to apply the wisdom of the earlier times to their lifestyle. So what's there? They're from one source. They are trusting in a community, a shared collective consciousness of wisdom and values and a way to live, and an effort to keep that alive on behalf of future generations. There's no need for priestcraft or hierarchy or power. None of that's necessary. The myth is encapsulated all. There's a hand in the back and then one over here, way in the back.
So what is it, in effect, that the stories we were told as children, most of us remember, perhaps not every
what's so special? What is it that captivates us? Even if we don't remember all the details of a particular myth, what is it that is reminiscent within us? And in some ways, those early human voices retelling these myths were actually playing the instrument. They were plucking the heartstrings of the listeners. It is said that in early manifestation of spirit gradually emanating and evolving into physical form, there came a time in earlier races where once mind was, we say, lit up, spirit, mind, and soul was able to incarnate into the physical form we now call the human. At that time, certain intrinsic ideas were impressed. And if you look at any sandbox, the kids have a notion of, I am, this is fair, that's not fair. There's certain intrinsic values that are there. And from the sandbox, they're looking up at giants, aren't they? All wise, all knowing, they think. Huge giants that come and manipulate their lives and times and environments. So if we have certain impressed values and concepts and notions that are in the collective consciousness, and we hear, and nowadays read, or see in film and video, if we become aware of something that's an embodiment of a reflection of that, that's going to pluck that intuitive nature or that heartstring. And therefore, it's familiar, therefore, it's comforting, and therefore, in a certain way, it's far more spiritually uplifting than anything truly external in the way of a rite or a ritual. There was a hand here, and then you lay in the corner over here.
Yes, you mentioned a period of time where hunters and gatherers and the oral traditions for people were writing. But then the next period was another period before that, where there was the writing of the mind. And in essence, there was a higher civilization. So how is it that we went back to almost rocks and having any sort of like high spiritual value, per se, and the arts and so on and so forth?
Well, you know, how come there was a golden age? There was an earlier time when there were tremendously wise souls walking among humans and instructing, and then we go into dark ages. We go into the periodic abyss of society. There have been many, many historians who have just worked with historical documentation. Really, the blink of an eye at the end of eons of development. And even they see the pattern of cause and effect, of cycles, of periodicity, that what goes up comes down. And for those of us that may be more scientific, we were used to plotting a sine curve. Those of us that are old enough to remember the biorhythm information of the early 1970s, remember plotting different biorhythms for different aspects of human life. But we also know in the work of people like Toynbee that the rise and fall of civilizations, that there are certain karmic time periods when a particular set of people tend to be at the top. They tend to be enjoying a golden age of art and literature and expressions of soul wisdom. And then for a variety of different reasons, karmically, what comes about is they hit a crisis point and they tip, and then they can go into a very dark, materialistic, kind of uninspired period of time as well. And so too, if that's the lower, that's the microcosm of human nature, then we know that periodically at the macrocosmic level, at the universal level, there would be the same kind of pulsation where there is the beginning of an expression of spirit at the very highest essence that we can imagine that gradually then becomes more materialized in terms of form. And at those very pure states of spirit moving into matter, there are tremendous periods of golden times, of times when soul and spirit can inform all vehicles and all substance, And then very gradually across time, things devolve. Things happen karmically by cause and effect so that they become less and less. And certainly in our modern times, we can track a history of certain institutions that literally created a dark age, literally put a lid on a pot and tried to squash the earlier myths in order to gain control and to manipulate. Your hands this up.
But if you go back to the universal aspect, you've spoken about an impression given to the early humanity. Well, spirit, as you said, begins the process. So you begin with the highest.
Mm-hmm.
And those beings we would call gods, superior beings from other periods of evolution, came to instruct infant humanity. But we use the sandbox as an analogy. Well, it's the exact same thing.
Yes.
You have to let the children in the sandbox do their own growing, take on their own responsibility, so those instructors move back. They have provided the myths and the sciences and the arts. It's all there as an impression, and then it's what we, as individuals, decide to do.
So there is the theoretical, the impress, the ideal, and then because we are thinkers, just as those souls that incarnated as those early humans around the campfires, there was free will, there was choice, the ability, the power to perceive and think and create and move from spirit into ideation, into action, and therefore into effect, was available to them. And everything then comes about. Way in the corner. Sure. The question refers to a talk that many of us had to miss on Prometheus Bound and all the symbology of that particular Greek myth. But one of the wonderful things that the founders of the Theosophical movement in the late 1800s did for the people in the West was to wave or shine a light, literally, not wave a flag, but to shine a light on the fact that myths exist across all times and places and cultures in all geographical regions. And if you can find a trace of an original myth and line it up with any others, you should see certain commonalities if there is truth. A lot of work has been done on the story of the flood, the Old Testament story. And when I say a lot of work has been done, anthropologically, an awful lot has been done since the late 1800s to track that particular myth. And probably most everybody in the room, when I say the flood, there are certain things that come to mind. And double check yourself. Did you think about unmitigated water covering everything? A deluge beyond anything in comparison in modern times. Bigger than a tsunami. Did you think about darkness? Dark was on the water. Did you think about a covenant? Some sense of trust with something higher and eternal that was going to save the temporary. Did you think about choice? Things were going to be chosen to be saved. that there was a choice to follow the covenant, follow the spiritual teaching, or not. Did you think about a vehicle, the ark? Perhaps you were thinking in terms of male and female, and the seeds, the basis for a future of existence again. A white dove, or a dove, might have come into your mind. And an olive branch, some signal that the water was receding and it was time to come again. But we could have a wonderful, wonderful chat, probably that would last the whole afternoon, on all those things that came to your mind. And frankly, I deliberately did not use any names. In the West, after the hierarchy of the church and the medieval times, for many people on the streets, they're going to automatically say, oh, the Noah story, of course, because that's the Judeo-Christian commonality among many in the society. But did you know that Noah is also called Nuah in Egyptian? Or were you aware that the Epic of Gilgamesh, coming out of the Chaldean traditions, far preceding that of the Hebrew, Gilgamesh has those exact same experiences and details to the story. You may have not known that before Gilgamesh, there was a person named Utnapishtim who had that same experience. And in fact, there around the turn of the century, 1900, there was a Dr. Richard Andry, who was an early folklore cultural anthropologist, who found 88 flood stories. And he worked since the 1800s. And subsequent to his finding 88 identical flood stories from around the world with these symbols, archaeologists have been very busy providing physical evidence of this tremendous flood that occurred. Now we might say, that's really amazing. And then if you go online, some of these flood stories, it's not 88 in 2010. Now there's information of closer to 200 such stories. Well, if we stop and think for a while, there's Plato's Republic, and he has these wonderful mythological concepts of the cave and light and shadow and reality and illusion. But he also spoke of Atlantis. In the Theosophical movement, there are myths and legends that state that there are periodic periods where a deluge or a fire, but usually a deluge, some upsetment, wipes out a particular culture, the globe physically changes, and then there's a coming again of human beings in a new expression, perhaps a new race. So that would be one of the most universal. And you have a follow-up to your question? The story of the virgin birth and a Messiah, a wise one, an enlightened soul coming through to teach, is another, again, it would take hours for us to line things up, but you can very easily use the literature in the reference library to look into the fact that that story of the Christian birth is not unique. That particular legend and all its symbology is intact at least across four different individuals, saviors or avatars or these great Mahatmas across time, masters that come in a pure birth, referring to a karmically pure birth as opposed to a physical virgin mother. But the stories are almost exactly the same, to the point of the heavens having stars, to people traveling to pay homage to the newborn infant, to the nature of the child, the symbology of being a shepherd to lead lambs. That symbology often exists. Trees of wisdom, crucifixions, that symbology often exists. And again, it would be a whole different study, but it's another example of a mythology recurring over and over and over because there is essence of truth in it. Your hand went up.
Oh. Yes, I was thinking of the story of Solomon and the Lion of the Temple, which has never been had in archaeological evidence. And then you read in the Bible where it says that God said that he dwells in the human body, which is the temple. So I'm kind of surprised that someone would pick that St. Paul for dealing with this when he is working from a book that at first appears to be hints, direction for the point of the greater truth. So it's really kind of surprising that St.
Paul. The speaker is surprised that St. Paul being called someone who would generate myths seems to be such a contradiction when if you look in the New and the Old Testament, it's a collection of a particular group of folks, myths and legends and archives invite their adherents to read the Bible. That the Bible is delivered in sermons on Sundays, and the lessons to be learned are delivered by a particular religious instructor. But there's not an invitation to read it privately and to think about it. The lady in pink had her hand up a long time, and then we'll come back to the center. So the next question, excuse me, what we do here is to direct the questions here. Okay, but let's go back then. The divine spark does not evolve. So let's go back to an earlier question, and the new rendition of it is why, if we are emanations of spirit, if we are emanations of that causeless cause, that prime mover, that first stirring of spirit that comes out of the absolute, and if eternally and as thinkers, that's our true nature. Why is it that we are incarnate into flesh, into limitation, and at an early period of time we're using physical forms that are, as now, frail and temporary and fragile? Why? We are a process. We are the exemplification of a process of spirituality. If we theorize, if we accept the first hypothesis that there is an absolute, there is a fount, there is a source that is beingness, that has absolutely no qualities or categories, but is the potential of all, and that's beautifully described in the pages of the Bhagavad Gita. That is, and we, our finite minds just can't even begin to wrap our, we can't, it's just all encompassing. Gradually, what happens is that which we are in spirit emerges as an emanation from that source, gradually becomes more and more and more individualized. And the goal of life is for spirit to work through the harmony of mind, of all the different instrumentations, emotions, of the psychic nature, the intellectual nature, in order to inform, impress the substance that we are using in our various vehicles. And so we come as spirit out of an absolute. Collectively, we gradually radiate into individual effort as individual thinkers, apparently, but still at one with the source. And very gradually, according to our own choices, our own will that we color with our own desires, we begin to use the powers available to us in any particular incarnation, hopefully, most idealistically, in the service of the lives of the physical vehicles that we're using, in the service of the entire manifestation, to lift up that substance and that lesser degree of soul, of consciousness or awareness, so that gradually all begins to spiral throughout evolutionary periods so vast we can only begin to understand. Do you have a fast follow-up to this before this lady? So growth is an individual experience, and it is therefore of this plane. It is of the most, the grosser aspects of soul, of mind, of lower mind, of physicality. And that which is I, that we know is unchanging within our incarnation, is an aspect of that which is eternal and unchanging. For how else would we know that we've changed unless there's a permanent, you can't measure things with a rubber ruler. There has to be a permanent entity that can determine what the change is. I'm sorry, your hand was up a long time ago. Lady in green. Yeah. Thank you. The comment is extremely welcome, and it's true. Much of the work that was started in the late 1800s is really blossoming, and it's blossoming cross-discipline-wise, as you say, in terms of science and philosophy and archaeology and all these different studies, we're beginning to see applications. In April, three lodges, New York, Philadelphia, and Washington, D.C., are getting together and at the Constitution Center here in Philadelphia, there will be an all-day-long symposium. And one of the goals is to look at certain ancient sites around the world and with the certain ancient messages and what the application is in modern times. More will be published on that in a little bit. Yeah. It's a wonderful time to be incarnate, to follow the, you know, in the 1870s, much of this was presented as a reminder, hey, you can start looking outside the box, and there's lots of ancient wisdom, and that's where, you know, you can learn a lot about human nature. Even the translation of the Gita, what literally chuckles this student frequently, is listening to folks that are life coaches and psychologists. What they're actually doing is teaching the Gita, and how old is that psychological treatise? You know, so what appears to be new right now is new in this incarnation for this brain, and it's exciting. And there have been this long line of sages for generations and thousands of years who have been very aware. Imagine the souls that knew to create those pyramids. So the hero's journey, wherever and however we can find it, is really the journey, the pilgrimage of the soul across many incarnations. Well, ultimately, the ultimate purpose of myth, and we're going to close with this because we're just about out of time, is that myths are the training of the lower mind, aren't they? You know, it's one thing to hear a myth or read a myth, or look at investigations and evidence about a particular myth or building or happening and not have the right keys. We know if we start with the wrong premise, our logic can take us so off track that it's unbelievable. So in many ways, a myth is a training for a mind. There are symbols, there are certain languages used, certain terms that are used, and we are invited to use our imagination, our intuition, and our discernment. It's incredibly important to become critically aware of what the story is, what the mask is, and then to peel off the layers and look within, to look at the spirit of the letter, not the law of the letter. So analogy and correspondence, that's the way to go. And in the process of our choosing to do that, we take with us all of the lives around us and we influence all of life as we know it. Have a great week and have fun with the Knicks.